How do you handle that jerk at work? You know who I mean, your passive-aggressive coworker, your demeaning boss. Even in good office environments, there are inevitably colleagues who are challenging to deal with. But not dealing with them isn't really a choice. Well, help is here in the form of a new book called Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People, by Amy Gallo. Amy is a contributing editor at Harvard Business Review, the author of the HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict, and a co-host of HBR's Women at Work podcast. She joins us now to share five big ideas from her book.
Hi, I'm Amy Gallo, author of the book Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People. I'm also co-host of the Harvard Business Review's Women at Work podcast and a contributing editor at HBR. I'm going to share with you five insights from my book. Insight number one. Our definition of who's a difficult person is often informed by bias. You can't talk about navigating tricky relationships at work without paying close attention to issues of bias and prejudice, in particular, microaggressions, social identity threat, gaslighting, power, coalition building, and allyship. It's important we examine the role bias plays, especially in what and who we define as difficult. Yes, it's tempting to use that label or even the word toxic when talking about someone who pushes our buttons, but we need to remember our interpretation is informed by our own biases and prejudices. I'll share an example I'm not particularly proud of. When I was working as a consultant, I had a client, a Black woman, who I was hesitant to push back on because I worried she would get angry. One of her direct reports, a fellow white woman, stopped me in the hallway of their offices one day and mentioned that I seemed to be holding back with her boss. When I said something about wanting to keep the client happy, she responded, "She's not going to bite your head off." Forced to reflect, I realized I was allowing unfair stereotypes to influence my view of this client. In fact, I'd seen her direct reports challenge her multiple times, and she took it well. I'd never seen her irate. Not only was I doing her a disservice by typecasting her, I was also failing to do my job, which was to present new ideas and challenge the status quo, all because of some imagined backlash. Our brains are wired to conserve resources, so they take shortcuts, rapidly putting people and things into categories and assigning attributes to those categories informed by societal, sociological, and historical constructs of race, gender, sexual orientation, or class. Certain groups are labeled as easygoing, others as smart, still others as threatening. So before you decide that someone in your life is difficult, play devil's advocate with yourself, repeatedly asking whether you are seeing the situation impartially. Ask, if your colleague was a different gender, race, sexual orientation, would you make the same assumptions or be willing to say the same things or treat them the same way? I used this tactic when I examined my reaction to my client. Would I assume she was going to be angry if she was a white woman or a white man or even a Black man? The answer was clear, no. If the client were a man, I might have interpreted the same behavior as passionate or committed or maybe curt at worst. But anger wouldn't have come to mind. This was an important exercise for me to recognize my own questionable logic and to begin to move beyond it. Insight number two, your perspective is just one perspective. When you're trying to sort out a contentious situation with a colleague, there's rarely an objective truth. We all come to the workplace with different perspectives and sets of values. We disagree on everything from whether it's okay to be 5 minutes late to a meeting to if it's justifiable to interrupt someone who is going on and on. It's not realistic to think you'll work with people who see eye to eye with you all the time. There's a concept from social psychology called naive realism that explains just how different our perspectives can be. Naive realism is the tendency to believe that we're seeing the world around us objectively, and if someone doesn't see it the same way, they're uninformed, irrational, or biased. One study in this area looked at what happened when participants were asked to tap out the rhythm of a well-known song, such as Happy Birthday, and listeners tried to guess the song. Those doing the tapping thought the listeners would guess the tune around 50% of the time, which was a huge overestimation, given that they only guessed right 2.5% of the time. Once we know something, like the tune of a song or the perfect solution to this quarter's budget shortfall, we find it hard to imagine that others won't recognize it too. Naive realism is connected to another relevant cognitive bias, fundamental attribution error. This is the inclination to assume another person's behavior has more to do with their personality than it does with the context or situation. If your colleague is late to a meeting, you might presume it's because they're disorganized or disrespectful, not because they were caught in traffic or in another meeting that ran over. But we do the opposite when it comes to ourselves. When you're running behind, you probably focus on all the circumstances that led to you being late, not the idea that you're a flawed human. Remember those two concepts when you're dealing with a coworker you find difficult. You can spend hours debating whose interpretation of the situation is correct, but reaching agreement on the facts is very unlikely. But you don't have to agree to get along. You need a path forward, not a shared worldview. That often starts by challenging your own perspective. Ask questions like, what if I'm wrong? How would I act differently? How do I know that what I believe is true? What assumptions have I made? How would someone with different values and experiences see things differently? The answer to the questions matter less than the exercise of asking them. They are an important way of reminding yourself that your view is just that, your view. Others see things differently, and that's okay. Insight number three, it's not just negative relationships that we need to attend to. Part of the reason that it's so important to make an effort to improve your negative relationships is that they have a disproportionate impact on our experience at work. Georgetown professor Christine Porath found that de-energizing relationships have a 4 to 7 times greater impact on our well-being than energizing positive relationships. However, a relationship doesn't have to be toxic or even mostly negative to have these effects. When I think about the difficult people I've worked with, many of the ones that stand out in my mind are those who weren't challenging all the time. For instance, I had a colleague, let's call her Tara. We were never friends exactly, but we enjoyed chatting at the beginning of meetings and at social gatherings, and she and I often talked about our young families, comparing notes. I found her funny, personable, and good at her job. Most of the time. When I got up the nerve to ask another of our coworkers whether he also found her difficult to read at times, he perfectly articulated what I was experiencing. He said, "You just never know which Tara you're going to get. Good Tara is really nice and seems to have your back, but bad Tara is grumpy and focused on her career and has no qualms about throwing you under the bus." Most of our work relationships don't fall into neat categories of good or bad, even if that's how our brains want to sort them. These ambivalent relationships, the ones that feel occasionally positive or mostly neutral but sometimes veer into alarming territory, are often just as problematic as the unambiguously negative ones. Some research has shown that these relationships are in fact more physiologically harmful. Of course, having a frenemy is better than having an enemy, and these ambivalent relationships can have upsides too. Sometimes they motivate us to work harder on the relationship, whereas we might take a purely positive relationship for granted. And we're more likely to try seeing things from the other person's perspective as we struggle to understand them. None of our relationships are fixed. We might assume that the positive ones will always stay that way, and the negative ones are doomed to be torturous forever. But that mindset can lead us to neglect our work friendships and completely dismiss the more complicated ones. If you think about the people you've had connections with over your career, I'm guessing they didn't remain the same over time. They were likely malleable. After all, good relationships can sour, and some of the toughest ones can be transformed, as long as you put in the time and effort. Insight number four. Escalating is an option, but it has to be done carefully. When your good faith efforts at improving your dynamic with a coworker don't work, there's always the option of going to your boss or another higher up in the hopes that they will handle the situation. This is a tricky move, though, so you need to weigh the trade-offs carefully. Will escalating the issue make you look bad? Do you risk further damaging your relationship with your colleague if they find out you went behind their back or brought in reinforcements? Will the person you appeal to believe you. Escalation only works if the person has the power, motivation, and skills to do something about it. And that's not always the case. Ask yourself, who is the right person or department to go to? Will they be open to helping you? Will they be discreet? Do they have the skills or authority to give your difficult colleague feedback? Are they sufficiently motivated to take action? Turning to other people doesn't always work, especially if they are ill-equipped or unwilling to address your colleague's behavior. Plus, if they solve the problem for you, perhaps behind closed doors, you won't develop the skills you need to deal with similar issues in the future. Before approaching a potential ally, whether they're your boss, your boss's boss, an HR representative, or someone else, think about how they've responded to comparable situations in the past. Did they give good advice? Did they follow through if they offered assistance? Did they make things better, or perhaps worse? The answers to these questions will help you decide whether it's actually a good idea to escalate or not. Insight number 5. Yes, sometimes we have to be the adult in the room. One of the things I hate most about dealing with difficult relationships is it feels like I have to do all the work while the other person gets to continue misbehaving or mistreating others. Why should you do all the work when the other person is at least partly to blame? There are two reasons. First, in any tense exchange, regardless of who's at fault, you can only truly control your thoughts, actions, and reactions. Second, even if you're absolutely certain that you're right and they're wrong, it almost always takes two to tango. Maybe your optimism and tendency to downplay risks spurs your pessimistic colleague to point out more of them. Or perhaps because you've inadvertently signaled to your coworker that you don't like direct confrontation, they've resorted to passive-aggressive tactics to get their point across. The clearer you can be about your role in the dust-up, even if it's minor, the clearer a resolution will become. It's not about beating them at their own game or even out-strategizing them. It's about experimenting with different tactics to find solutions for your particular situation and that feel right for you. In fact, sometimes trying something new, even something small, can shift the dynamic between you and a coworker who gets under your skin. The key is to recognize that your colleague is unlikely to transform into an entirely different person. Ultimately, you have little say over whether and how much someone else is willing to change. Also, your relationship with your coworker isn't something that's happening to you. It's a dynamic that you likely participate in and therefore have the ability to do something about. Although we can't control how our brain instinctively reacts to a stressful situation, we can reappraise and alter our perception and response. Similarly, you may not be able to change how a colleague behaves, but you can change the way you interpret and respond to their behavior. Keeping that in mind will improve your chances of building stronger, more fulfilling relationships at work. It can help to remind yourself that there are very likely times that you've been the difficult coworker. I mean, who among us hasn't acted like a know-it-all on occasion, or acted passive-aggressively, or fallen into the victim role at times? Admitting that our coworkers are flawed, but probably aren't evil, and that we aren't infallible ourselves is essential to getting along. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you'll check out the book.
Thank you, Amy. You've just listened to 5 big ideas from Getting Along, How to Work with Anyone, Even Difficult People by Amy Gallo. If you're still having problems, check out our book bite for Jerks at Work, Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them by Tessa West. I'm Rufus Griscom. Have a great day.